Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 985, Fascism, 2017 European Tour, Part 2. This is being recorded on November 21st of the year 2017. In this program, as obviously indicated by the title, we're going to continue to look at fascist manifestations around Europe, and in turn and in particular, I think, noting a number of elements of commonality with things that are very much on the front burner here in the U.S., in particular vis-a-vis Team Trump and those who are supporting Trump. One of the things to be looking at is the effect of austerity on much of the population. In some cases, we are going to look at that in Italy, the economic collapse of 2008 has wrought a great deal of suffering among those who are working for a living and, in general, less fortunate. And at the same time, as in particular as the Republicans and Team Trump have done, the very people who are implementing the brutal class warfare and economic exclusionism toward people who are less fortunate, their fellow citizens who are less fortunate than themselves, are pointing a diverting finger toward those people, whoever those people might be in the U.S., blacks, Latinos, Muslims, throughout much of the Western world. It is, quote, immigrants, in particular Muslim immigrants fleeing the catastrophic events precipitated by war in the Middle East, and in places like India, which has a significant, we're not going to be talking about India in this program, but India does have, in spite of the partition that took place, when India and Pakistan got their independence from the British Empire, India still has a large Muslim population. And those Muslims have been stigmatized for all kinds of things and treated brutally by the Hindutva or Hindu nationalist fascists of Narendra Modi and the RSS. The RSS is the Hindutva fascist organization that murdered Mahatma Gandhi. Narendra Modi's BJP is a cat's paw for that organization. Noting not only the elements of commonality between many of the neo-fascist movements that we're going to be talking about here and things that are quite evident here in the U.S., also the Orwellian nature of what is going on in Ukraine and what is continuing to go on in Ukraine, in which the fascists of the OUNB and their military wing, the UPA, are being completely remade from the participants in and accessories to the genocide of the World War II period into heroes, freedom fighters, if you will. We have spoken about that in the past, and we will be picking that up again. Some of the things that we will be talking about here, I have covered in other programs. What is perhaps most significant about the Orwellian rewriting of World War II history in Ukraine is the extent to which that is being, to the extent to which our media are collaborating with that. In Ukraine, it is now a criminal offense to criticize the OUNB or the UPA if one states the obvious, which is that the OUNB was a Nazi collaborating organization in World War II, and the UPA under Roman Shukevich was an organization that helped to staff many of the SS extermination units and the Schutzmannschaft, the Ukrainian auxiliary police that assisted with not only the Holocaust against Jews, but participated in the brutal anti-Polish massacres of World War II. And in general, they fought on behalf of Nazi Germany against the former Soviet Union as well. If someone in this country basically tells the truth about what took place in World War II and the revision of what is happening in Ukraine, then one is labeled, if you're lucky, you'll just be called a conspiracy nut, if not a Kremlin dupe or an actual agent of influence of Russia. What is happening here is altogether Orwellian as well. I will note in passing that in For the Record 982, the description, I actually spoke about this in the For the Record 967, but in For the Record 982, Representative John Conyers of Michigan was labeled the Kremlin's man in Congress for having allegedly started the meme that the Azov Battalion, AZOV, I've been mispronouncing that, Azov, was a Nazi organization. Well, it bloody well is. Many of its members are more or less out front about that. They wear the swastika and the SS rune on their combat helmets. And their spokesperson is Roman Zvorich, who in the early 1980s was the personal secretary to Yaroslav Spetsko, the head of the World War II Nazi collaborationist government in Ukraine. Zvorich then became the Minister of Justice, the equivalent of Attorney General under the Yushchenko government and both Tymoshenko governments in Ukraine. And John Conyers was labeled the Kremlin's man in Congress for supposedly starting the meme, in other words, the political internet rumor that the Azov Battalion was Nazi. The Azov Battalion is now receiving training and arming from the Pentagon. And I would note that in today's news, Conyers is now being saddled with allegations, perhaps true or not, he denies them, of sexual harassment. He is the latest liberal figure to be felled beneath that particular political and rhetorical axe. Whatever the actual factual situation may be, I don't think it is accidental that, quote, the Kremlin's man in Congress, unquote, which is libelous in and of itself, is now the latest to be politically tarred with that particular brush. But again, the Orwellian nature of what is happening in Ukraine is perhaps most significant for the collaboration on the part of not only our media, but much of the Western media establishment, with the Trump and Kampferbande, the Trump administration, now poised to eliminate net neutrality. It will be interesting to see what happens to internet outlets that dare to tell the truth about what is happening in Ukraine, including, frankly, the SpitfireList.com website. I would recommend that as the portcullis of political darkness and censorship descends on the U.S., that people who take this program and my work seriously take it upon themselves to click on the link on the written descriptions for the record to obtain the flash drive that contains all of my life's work, because who knows how much longer people are going to be able to access that on the internet, those who are not able to actually hear the program on the radio, and that is a relatively limited audience.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Now, the first stop for our European tour, or Fascism 2017 European tour, is Poland. And this is interesting for a number of reasons. Not only were the Poles on the receiving end of some of the most brutal treatment by the OUNB and the UPA, some 100,000 Poles were done to death by the OUNB and UPA in World War II. But the Poles themselves were among the most brutal recipients of Nazi ethnic cleansing. The Poles, being Slavs, were deemed to be subhumans, and they were only supposed to be taught to count to 10. And within 6 months of the Nazi occupation of Poland, much of the Polish intelligentsia was completely liquidated. Nonetheless, however, Sieg Heil and other Nazi cheers and ideological rhetorical rallying points are being heard in the streets of Poland. You know things are getting bad when the New York Times has columns expressing worry about neo-fascism on their op-ed page. The New York Times, sadly, has been complicit in an awful lot of what has taken place in the last 50-plus years, and their stance vis-a-vis what is happening in Ukraine is simply scandalous. Nonetheless, I guess, under the circumstances, the New York Times is the broken clock that is right twice a day. From the Times of November 17th of 2017, an op-ed column by Jan T. Gross, G-R-O-S-S, a teacher at Princeton, Poles cry for pure blood, unquote, again. It reads in part, "If you want a sense of where Poland could be heading, look no further than the events last Saturday in Warsaw. Tens of thousands of people, many of them young men with crew cuts, but some parents with children too, flocked to the Polish capital to celebrate Independence Day in a march organized in part by two neo-fascist organizations. The marchers waved white and red Polish flags, brandished burning torches, think Charlottesville, and they wore white power symbols. They carried banners declaring death to enemies of the homeland and screamed, 'Sieg Heil and Ku Klux Klan.' The official slogan of the march was, 'We want God,' words from an old hymn that President Trump quoted during his speech in Warsaw in July. A dozen incredibly courageous women showed up to protest the march. After mixing with the marchers, they unraveled a long strip of cloth emblazoned with 'Stop Fascism,' unquote. They were immediately attacked and their banner was ripped apart. Marchers pushed some of the women to the ground and kicked others. Were these women exaggerating in calling the march fascist? Or are we, in fact, witnessing a resurgence of fascism in Poland? To steal a phrase, I believe the women." And skipping down about some of the political and historical background to these developments, ever since the Law and Justice Party won both the presidential and parliamentary elections in 2015, Poland has been undergoing a disturbing political transformation. Law and Justice is an Orwellian name for a party that constantly violates the law, breaks constitutional provisions, and is hell-bent on subjecting the courts to its control. The party is dismantling the institutional framework of parliamentary democracy piece by piece in order to remove any restraints on the personal power of its leader, Jarosław Kaczynski. Prezes, P-R-E-Z-E-S, or the boss, people call him. 2 years ago, the party bet that latching on to the refugee crisis in Europe would give it purchase on the votes necessary to win. Its calculation proved entirely correct. One of the first institutions the party hijacked was public television. Law and Justice has turned it into Fox News on steroids paid for by the Polish taxpayers. It feeds viewers nonstop propaganda about the mounting threat to Poland's sovereignty from the European Union, specifically in the form of Muslim refugees. Those refugees present a threat to our way of life, the government and the press insist. They will assault our women, they say, and they are carrying infectious diseases to boot. A year ago, a quarter of Poles opposed accepting anyone fleeing the ravages of war in the Middle East. After months of relentless propaganda, 75%, or three times as many, are now opposed. This year, the country has let in only 1,474 asylum seekers, nearly all of them from Russia or Ukraine. Yet the marchers in Warsaw seem to feel that their country is being overwhelmed. "We don't want Muslims here," they cried. "No to Islam," and "Refugees, get out." And after talking about an historical event in which John Sobieski, a 17th-century Polish king, played a primary role in defeating the Turks in the Battle of Vienna, and the historical pride that plays in Polish political consciousness, the writer Jan Loos goes on to say, "While the Warsaw demonstrators paraded with burning torches, Mr. Kaczynski gave a speech in Krakow expressing a new twist on this familiar narrative. The Poles' mission now is to save a sick Europe from itself. The neo-fascist marchers in Warsaw suggested, as if on cue, how that could be done. Pure blood, read one banner. White Europe, another said." And then talking about how this kind of xenophobia in Poland has historically been aimed at Jews. The writer says, "It was the ideological about anti-Semitism. It was the ideological cornerstone of the pre-war National Democratic Party of Roman Dmowski, D-M-O-W-S-K-I, at whose statue the Independence Day March began this year. A youth organization that helped organize the march in Warsaw is a descendant of a fascist offshoot of the party whose members took to the streets in the 1930s to beat Jews and slash them with razor blades affixed to wooden canes." And like it goes on, skipping down, "Half of the 6 million Jewish victims of the Holocaust were Poles. 2 million more Poles were killed during the German occupation. How many deaths are required for leaders to learn that words and ideas can kill?" But I think Jan Gross may be, certainly rhetorically he may be, or she, I don't know if, the gender of the writer, may actually be using words to kill, certainly to incite, and they may indeed be aiming at just such a goal. Another article about that march, this from an AP story from Talking Points memo of November 11th of 2017 by Vanessa, V-A-N-E-S-S-A, Gera, G-E-R-A. 60,000 people join far-right march on Poland's Independence Day. And it notes that in addition to the Polish fascist participants in the march, there were fascists from other countries as well. Skipping down. The march has become one of the largest such demonstrations in Europe, and on Saturday it drew far-right leaders from elsewhere in Europe, including Tommy Robinson from Britain and Roberto Fiore, F-I-O-R-E, from Italy. Roberto Fiore is someone we have spoken about in a number of shows. He is the head of an organization in Italy, Forza Nuova, and we're going to hear more about that. That is part of the Italian neo-fascist milieu around Silvio Berlusconi, the Alleanza Nazionale, and Gianfranco Fini, and the various pentacles of the P2 Lodge, Orazio Gelli. We have spoken about that milieu for decades here on this program, and there is abundant information about that in the archives. Specifically, I spoke about Roberto Fiore in For the Record 307. We're going to hear more about him shortly. Turning to Italy, and once again, I want to stress a couple of things. First of all, the continuity between the fascism of the World War II period and the contemporary outcroppings of fascism in that country. Also, and this is a New York Times story, so naturally they, I think, can be counted upon to do what they're doing, which is to downplay the real historical impact of fascism in post-World War II Italy, although nominally banned by the Italian Constitution. In fact, organizations like the MSI, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, the Alleanza Nazionale, the, quote, post-fascists, unquote, of Gianfranco Fini, and most importantly, the consummately powerful and yet clandestine influence of the Propaganda Due Lodge of Mussolini supporter Licio Gelli, have perpetuated fascism within Italian institutions, its business community. Berlusconi is a member of was a member of P2. He is a dominant media figure in Italy. And within the Italian national security establishment, members of the P2 MSI milieu have been front and center as well. So note that the New York Times here, well, I guess this is the New York Times being the New York Times and sort of downplaying the post-World War II role of fascism in Italy. And yet I think there are a number of points in this article that are worth underscoring. A small Italian neo-fascist party called Casa Pound, that's capital C-A-S-A, capital P-O-U-N-D, one word, that is named for the American poet Ezra Pound, who was a supporter of Mussolini and did broadcasts supportive of Mussolini and was jailed for a time after World War II. Actually, I guess he was interned in a psychiatric clinic because he was supposedly nuts for supporting Mussolini, and he came out and was a relatively famous picture of him giving the fascist salute after emerging from the hospital, proving that, I guess, he was the cure failed under the circumstances. Note here, however, as I indicated at the top of the program, the role of austerity and the ravages that austerity has wrought among Italian working people and the suffering that has stemmed from that. And Casa Pound, at least to a certain extent, is presenting themselves as something of an antidote to that. They are also scapegoating non-whites for this suffering in Italy, very much like many of the Polish marchers were, and very much like neo-fascists elsewhere, including here in the U.S., have been doing as well. But again, note the suffering that austerity and the economic collapse of 2008 have wrought among working people and people closer to the bottom of the economic totem pole. And note how the fascists are able to successfully market themselves as the antidote to that suffering, because they're going to take care of those people. And again, this is a very, very common theme. Excerpting some key passages from this article from the New York Times of November 17th, 2017, an article by Jason Horowitz. In Italy, a neo-fascist party's small win creates big unease. When the candidate for a neo-fascist party, Casa Pound, won a seat this month on the municipal council of the Roman suburb of Ostia, O-S-T-I-A, many Italians were startled. But they really took notice days later when a television reporter arrived to interview a Casa Pound supporter, a supporter who happened to belong to one of the area's most feared crime families and received a vicious, nationally broadcast headbutt that broke the reporter's nose. Last week, Italian journalists trekked to Austria to solemnly protest at the scene of the assault. Around the corner, residents were still celebrating, shrugging off the party's claims to be the direct descendant of Benito Mussolini's fascist party. "Look at what I'll show you," said one, Gianluca Antonucci, A-N-T-O-N-U-C-C-I, as he unzipped his jacket to reveal a black shirt featuring Mussolini's granite face. "Il Duce." For a while, this country seemed an outlier as nationalist and xenophobic forces made gains across Europe. But now some fear that Italy, the birthplace of fascism, is catching up with its neighbors. This month, thousands of Poles chanted "White Europe" during Independence Day marches, and the Freedom Party, founded by ex-Nazis, is in negotiations to join a coalition government in Austria. In Germany, the far-right Alternative for Germany now sits in the Bundestag. And then the article goes on to describe the name. The party, named after the American poet Ezra Pound, who supported Mussolini, is still statistically irrelevant on the national level. But Casa Pound is winning seats in a handful of towns, and some of its core beliefs are increasingly spreading throughout Italy. And skipping down, all of this makes Casa Pound's leaders hopeful that Italy is newly fertile ground for fascism. The Italian constitution bans, quote, the reorganization in any form of the dissolved fascist party, unquote. But Casa Pound and other neo-fascist movements have skirted the law by calling themselves the descendants of Mussolini. They insist that they believe in democracy and not a fascist dictatorship. By the way, it was none other than Licio Vieri himself who formulated the political doctrine of the democratic rebirth of fascism in Italy, reinstituting fascism in Italy through the use of the electoral process. Skipping down, of a neighborhood in Rome, on a recent afternoon, children of the roughly 20 families now residing there ran in its entryway brightly decorated with the names of the movement's heroes, including Julius Caesar, Benito Mussolini, and the right-wing philosopher Julius Evola. By the way, we spoke about Evola most recently in For the Record 947, and we discussed Evola at great length in many shows in decades past, including much of our treatment of Kevin Coogan's vitally important Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey, and the Post-War Fascist International. There is a lot of treatment of that book, including many interviews with Kevin Coogan himself on the archives on the SpitfireList.com website. Continuing with this article, of course, there was also Pound, who ranted against Jews on Italian radio and was imprisoned for treason during the war. The daughter of the poet has tried to make the party change its name. Members with black boots, tattooed necks, and shorn hair guard floors decorated with pictures of fascist-era marches and banners reading, "Arm Your Soul," unquote. Casa Pound has a more secular and socially tolerant approach than its hard-right cousin, Forza Nuova, which Italy's interior minister Marco Minniti banned from reenacting Mussolini's March on Rome last month. That is headed up by Roberto Fiori, whom we spoke about in For the Record 307, among other shows, and he was one of the attendees at the Polish Independence Day march, as we have seen. Continuing. Casa Pound members exhibit the same fondness as Forza Nuova for Roman salutes and mythic glory days. Casa Pound's leaders shrug off Mussolini's racial laws and alliance with Hitler with a nobody's perfect nonchalance. They instead prefer to focus on fascism's role in Italian modernization and military might. "That spirit of the nation bloomed in this country during those years," Mr. DiStefano said, "and I would like to bring that feeling back today," unquote. That is especially so in Ostia, a suburb of 230,000 home to joblessness, resentment toward immigrants, and an organized crime problem so insidious that the police disbanded the local government 2 years ago. The journalist who was headbutted was trying to interview a member of a powerful local clan called the Spadas, S-P-A-D-A-S, which had thrown its support behind Casa Pound. "I voted for Casa Pound, and I'm proud of it," said Marina Luglu, L-U-G-L-U, as she walked out of Bar Music, owned by the headbutter Roberto Spada, whom she admiringly called Mr. Roberto, unquote. Voters here rewarded the party for its engagement with their run-down housing projects. Casa Pound provided a food bank to hundreds of families, sent handymen to fix elevators, and lawyers to locals in need. So again, note the hardship that lingers from the financial collapse of 2008. Italy is among the so-called PIIGS countries, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain that have been demonized by Germany and other EU members and have been recipients of some of the most austere of the austerity doctrine in Europe. And note the anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim sentiment that has been able to flourish amidst that hardship. We're going to now move from Italy to Ukraine. One of the things that we have spoken about, and I'm going to recap material that we have read before, and that is the absolutely, almost explicitly Orwellian Institute for National Memory. That is headed up by a guy named Volodymyr Vyatrovich, who actually did some work at Harvard University in the U.S. in between his work on behalf of the Yushchenko government in the early years of the new century, and his recapitulation of that work when he was installed by Petro Poroshenko as the head of the Institute of National Memory. What that institute is doing is standing the history of Ukraine in World War II on its head. The OUNB, Nazi collaborationist organization, the Ukrainian fascist organization, are presented as nationalist heroes. Its military cadre, the UPA, which collaborated with the Nazis and the SS, are presented as freedom fighters. And in turn, the 14th Waffen-SS Division, the Galician Division, are presented as heroes who fought against anti-Semitism. One of the selling points for the Institute for National Memory has been to maintain that there was a prominent Jewish member, a guy named Leiba Dubrovsky, Leiba Dubrovsky, as we shall see, that was not the case. That he was not someone who joined the UPA in order to help further their wonderful attitudes towards Jews.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
From Haaretz of November 9th of 2017, an article by Jared McBride. Ukraine's invented a Jewish Ukrainian nationalist, unquote, to whitewash its Nazi era past. The Ukrainian Institute of National Memory, or UINP, and its patrons in the Poroshenko government in Kiev are allowing us to study the process of nationalist myth-making in real time. President Poroshenko has enabled nationalist activists like Volodymyr Vyatrovich, head of the Institute, to sculpt Ukraine's history and memory policies. Part and parcel of the Institute's decommunization campaign to remove remnants of a Soviet past simultaneously has been to lionize 20th century Ukrainians who fought for Ukraine's independence, no matter how problematic their problematic might be. In particular, the Vyatrovich and the Institute have made whitewashing the image of World War II Ukrainian nationalists a priority, not a small feat, considering their documented ties to and complicity with the Nazis. This nationalist revisionism seeks to show that the main wartime nationalist organizations, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUN, and its military wing, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, or UPA, were ultimately multi-ethnic, multicultural, and democratic. Not unsurprisingly, the nationalists' relationship with Ukraine's Jews has proved the biggest challenge to this reinvention of Holocaust co-perpetrators and ethnic cleansers as tolerant internationalists. Skipping down. Much Ukrainian media ink has been spilled in recent years glorifying the role of one Jew who served with the nationalists. His story encapsulates Ukraine's war on memory and its eager attempts to write out anti-Semitism from its wartime history. Leiba Itzko Yosifovich Dubrovsky has been touted as a Ukrainian nationalist who also happened to be Jewish. That was to make the point that Ukrainian nationalism and Jewishness were not mutually exclusive. These days, we'd call the re-engineering of facts about Dubrovsky, Dubrovsky, a fake news story, but it's instructive to trace its origins. The legend of Leva Dubrovsky, Ukrainian nationalist Jew, originated not in World War II, but in the mid-2000s, when he was first briefly mentioned in a book in 2006 by historian and activist Volodymyr Vyatrovich. Vyatrovich made reference to a Jew in the UPA who helped write leaflets for the UPA in 1942 and 1943, and eventually was arrested by the Soviets. In 2008, the Dubrovsky legend grew thanks to the exhibition Jews in the Ukrainian Liberation Movement, staged by the Ukrainian Security Service and the Institute for National Memory with the assistance of Vyatrovich. That, by the way, was under Viktor Yushchenko, skipping down. At this point, the myth of Jews happily serving with Ukrainian nationalists in World War II began to be reported in prestigious outlets like BBC Ukraine. After the Maidan Revolution of 2014 and Vyatrovich's further rise within the Ukrainian government, the Dubrovsky legend flourished. Skipping down. When I actually read Dubrovsky's file, The Legend of the Jew, eager to join the Ukrainian nationalists, quickly evaporated. Dubrovsky grew up in the Kiev region, finished law school, and was a Communist Party member from 1929. As a Red Army soldier, he was captured in 1941 and changed his name to Leonid Dubrovsky to appear Ukrainian. In this guise, he got out of captivity and went to northwestern Ukraine, where he accidentally met local Ukrainian nationalists connected to the local collaborationist police and administration, including the local mayor and later UPA member Mykola Krasinovsky. Noteworthy is that Krasinovsky, Krasinovski, was well known for his brutality toward Jews. Not suspecting that Dubrovsky was Jewish and appreciating his education, the nationalists recruited him to produce propaganda. In contrast to the shiny new nationalist legend, Dubrovsky actually concealed his Jewishness to his nationalist compatriots and was no enthusiastic supporter of Ukrainian nationalism. In fact, he was scared that they would find out who he really was. Dubrovsky had well-founded reasons for his reluctance and fear. He felt that Ukraine's nationalists, who deliberately helped staff local police forces under the German Nazi forces, were complicit in the genocide of the Jews. Skipping down again. He did not even believe in the nationalist claims that they were fighting the Germans, remarking that, quote, they did not kill a single local German Nazi leader in the area of Volhynia. And the article goes on. The article is reprinted, as are many of the articles that I have excerpted in the written description for the Record 985. That will be available within a day or two of the recording of this program. In the written description, I'm going to excerpt it briefly. There is another article about the Institute for National Memory and Volodymyr Vyatrovich. This is from Foreign Policy Magazine. That is the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations, a very mainstream organization. From May 2nd of 2016, an article by Josh Cohen, The Historian Whitewashing Ukraine's Past, and it talks about Volodymyr Vyatrovich. And after serving as head of the Institute for National Memory under Yushchenko, he then retreated to the U.S., where he worked at Harvard University, and then came back after the Maidan coup and began serving with the refurbished Institute for National Memory. A couple of excerpts. During this period, that was his stay in the U.S., Vyatrovich spent time in North America on a series of lecture tours, as well as a short sojourn as a research fellow at the Harvard University Ukrainian Research Institute, or HURI. He also continued his academic activism, writing books and articles promoting the heroic narrative of the OUN-UPA. In 2013, he tried to crash and disrupt a workshop on Ukrainian and Russian nationalism taking place at the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. When the Maidan Revolution swept Yanukovych out of power in February of 2014, Viatrovich returned to prominence. Viatrovich's rewriting of Ukrainian history has received support from, among other institutions, the Ukrainian Ministry of Education. Last June, Kvits, that is the Minister of Education, Kvits, KVIT's Ministry of Education, issued a directive to teachers regarding the, quote, necessity to accentuate the patriotism and morality of the activists of the liberation movement, unquote, including depicting the UPA as a symbol of patriotism and sacrificial spirit in the struggle for an independent Ukraine, and Stefan Bandera, head of the OUNB, as an outstanding representative of the Ukrainian people. Among the things that are being whitewashed, and this is particularly ironic in light of the Kaczynski regime's militantly anti-Russian stance and sympathy for the Poroshenko government in Ukraine, the UPA and the OUNB carrying out a brutal, well, really a war within a war. They killed some 100,000 Poles and did so in many cases extremely brutally, burning them alive, herding them into buildings and burning the buildings, chopping them up with axes. And that, too, is being whitewashed by the Institute for National Memory. UPA Supreme Commander Dmytro Bmytro Klyuchevsky, KLIACHKIVSKYI, explicitly stated, quote, we should carry out a large-scale liquidation action against Polish elements. During the evacuation of the German army, we should find an appropriate moment to liquidate the entire male population of Poland between 16 and 60 years old. Given that over 70% of the leading UPA cadres possessed a background as Nazi collaborators, none of this is surprising. And yet that doesn't seem to be bothering the Poles too much. And again, that article is excerpted at length in the written description for the program. One of the people that is receiving wonderful treatment by the Institute for National Memory is Roman Shukevich. And recapping an article that we looked at in For the Record 967, Ukraine City to hold festival in honor of Nazi collaborator whose troops killed Jews. This from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency from June 28th of 2017. I'm just going to describe what's here. This is the city of Lviv. You'll see that L-V-O-V or L-V-I-V when it was officially part of what eventually was to become Poland. It was called Lemberg, but it is the same city, whether Lemberg, as it was known to Poles, or Lviv, or Lviv, it is the same city. And on June 29th of 1941, the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, or Nightingale Battalion, as it is now known, marched into Lviv under the leadership of Roman Shukevich, who actually headed up the cadre of Ukrainian fascists who staffed this group. But the political officer and overall executive commander was an SS officer and a very important one at that, named Theodor Oberlander, whom we have spoken about at great length in the program. And what they did was to liquidate the Jewish population, killed some 5,000 Jews from the Lviv ghetto, and also liquidated 2,000 or 3,000 Polish intellectuals as well. And the city of Lviv has established June 30th as Shukevich Fest, in which they are celebrating Roman Shukevich, the head of the UPA, and the man whose son, Yuri Shukevich, continued his work with the UPA and the UNO-UNSA, or maybe it's UNA-UNSO, the successor organization to the UPA. The point being that the city of Lviv is now, or Lviv, is now holding a celebration every June 30th of Roman Shukevich, who led the Ansatz Group of Naftigal, or Naftigal Battalion. That was an offshoot of the UPA, and it is now a crime in Ukraine to criticize the UPA. And this is on the date of June 30th. It was on that date in 1941 when the massacre began. You will see references to that as the night to that unit as the Nightingale Battalion. I originally, in my studies, encountered that as the Einsatzgruppe Naftigal. It was an SS extermination unit that was staffed by Ukrainian nationalists or Ukrainian fascists from the UPA and OUNB.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Briefly, from the book The New Germany and the Old Nazis by P. H. Pettens. This was published in hardcover by Random House and copyright 1961. It is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. Of the Einsatzgruppe Naftigal. In 1959, Theodor Oberwander was the center of a storm that finally forced his resignation as the Minister of Ex-Ballet in May of 1960. He was blamed for the mass murder of thousands of Jews and Polish intellectuals who had been liquidated in July of 1941 when a special SS task force under his command occupied the Polish city of Lemberg, or Lviv. That, again, that's the Nightingale Group. As briefly mentioned in a previous chapter, Minister Oberwander is accused of having been involved in the so-called Lemberg Massacre, in which several thousand Poles and more than 5,000 Jews were slaughtered. Dr. Oberwander does not deny A, that he was the commanding officer of that special SS task force, the Nightingale Battalion, made up of nationalist Ukrainians, and B, that this battalion was the first German unit to move into the Polish city of Lemberg on June 29, 1941, where it remained for 6 or 7 days. Dr. Oberwander does deny that his troops committed any atrocities in Lemberg. He has said that during his stay in the city, not a shot was fired. Well, that is the group that is now that basically Shukevich Fest celebrates Roman Shukevich on the date that that massacre began. SS officer Oberlander, later a minister in the Adenauer government, was the political officer for that group. Again, an SS extermination unit. One of the things that we have spoken about in the past is that an early Ukrainian nationalist slash fascist, a guy named Simon or Semyon Petliura, P-E-P-L-I-U-R-A, you'll see it variously transliterated. He was celebrated with a nationwide minute of silence, and now there is a public monument in honor of Semyon Petliura. His troops in the immediate post-World War I period killed some 50,000 Jews. And in the Defending History blog of October 23rd of 2017, it is noted that when this statue was erected not far from a synagogue, it drew a lot of protest. It also drew protests from the World Jewish Congress, and that then a regional leader of the extremist Svoboda Party, one of the OUNB's successor organizations that we have spoken about in the past, threatened to exterminate the Jews of that area if they did not basically button their mouths. From regional leader of Ukraine's Svoboda Party threatens Jews who disagree with the public monument for Pogrommeister Petliura, again from the Defending History blog. It notes, in the face of when Jews and the World Jewish Congress protested the erecting of a statue of Petliura, in a Facebook rant, a regional leader of the extremist Svoboda Party, whose leader was once photographed making the Nazi salute, issued a blood-curdling Facebook threat to Ukraine's Jews, telling them to fall in line or face the consequences. And skipping down, the only time we comfortably coexisted with kikes is in Kolivshina, K-O-L-I-V-S-H-I-N-A, an 18th-century pogrom in which Ukrainians butchered Jews. He is saying that this massacre was the only time Ukrainians and Jews coexisted happily. I hope Ukrainians will remember who is in charge of their land and put all minorities in their place. Do not tell us how to live and to whom to put up monuments in our land. Do not tell us which language to speak and in which language to educate our children. We are Ukrainians, and that's all you need to know. You are our guests. If you want to live next to us, then get used to our rules. If not, go to your places in other nations, or else you will be punished. And organizations like the World Jewish Congress or the Jewish Telegraphic Agency or Haaretz have noted the rewriting of World War II and pre-World War II history in Ukraine, but you will notice that the Israeli government has remained silent. They are saying nothing, and that is not only disgraceful, but I think more than a little revealing, because Benjamin Netanyahu's father, Benzion Netanyahu, was the personal secretary for Vladimir Jabotinsky, the head of the Beitar, the most prominent of the fascist organizations within the Zionist movement, and Jabotinsky was a political ally of Semyon Petliura, the epic post-World War I Ukrainian pogromist. So perhaps it is not surprising that Netanyahu has remained silent. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty of October 14th of 2017. Nationalists mark 75th anniversary of Ukrainian Insurgent Army. The official day of founding, October 14th, is now a national holiday in Ukraine when the UPA was founded. Again, this is beyond Holocaust denial. It's Holocaust celebration. It is the open celebration of Nazi collaborationist elements. It is Serpent's Walk and fundamental revisionism. We're going to conclude by recapping a couple of articles about the Lithuanian Riflemen's Union. That is an organization which contributed to from political.eu from December 6th of 2016, an article by Jonathan Brown. Baltic Minutemen Fight Russian Foe. It's about the Lithuanian Riflemen's Unit training with the Lithuanian Army and similar formations from Latvia and Estonia. And it talks about their desire to fight Russians in the event of a Russian invasion, something I think is extremely unlikely to happen. And in a Global Post article from September 2nd of 2014 from the Agence France-Presse, Russian threat sees rebirth of Lithuania paramilitary group. It notes that the Lithuanian Riflemen's Union dates to the immediate post-World War I period and talks about them fighting on behalf of Nazi forces in Lithuania. As we have seen in the past, Lithuania became the second fascist country in Europe, and the Lithuanian Riflemen's Union collaborated with Nazi liberation forces, and then in the post-war period conducted efforts on behalf of the OPC, which morphed into the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. More information than I have been able to talk about here is in the written description for the show, which will be published presently. This concludes, For the Record, 985 Fascism, 2017 European Tour, Part 2, being recorded on November 21st of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.